This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And where were you before Canada?
So I was born in Sri Lanka, and I was born in 82, and then we... Once the civil war there got going, my parents and I migrated in 88, and I've kind of been in Toronto ever since.
Nice. Okay. How are things today in Sri Lanka? Is there still conflict?
The war came to an end in 2009, the actual civil war, but there are still ongoing issues of the government kind of seizing land, harassing minority communities, Muslim communities, and Tamil communities, and disrupting memorial services to the war and things like that. And so there are still issues, but in terms of the actual civil war, it's come to an end. It came to an end a while ago.
Okay. Do you still know people over there?
Yeah, I have quite a few friends still living there. I've been back a few times doing interviews and research, a good chunk of my family is also still in different parts of the country. So, yeah, I still have quite a few connections there.
Okay. And I know you mentioned your birth year. Would you consider yourself like a Gen X or like a very early millennial?
What is 1982? 1982 is probably millennial, I'm guessing, right? I don't know where I fit in terms of my personality, but I guess I'm, if 82 is millennial, then I'm in that category.
I remember I had listened to an interview you did. I forget the platform, but I was surprised to hear you're a fan of hip hop music, and it seemed like your artists that you liked fit, they're very different from what maybe like a young person today would say is their favorite. It seemed like very like lots of 1990s hip hop, early 2000s. Yeah. Maybe that was kind of cool.
I was a rapper myself from about 98 96 to 2000 2004 2005 I think, and so I'm whoever I grew up with during that period, who kind of matched my own writing style and how I approached it. I'm still kind of obsessed with that entire period. The recent stuff, some of it I like, but the whole like mumble rap phenomenon and the overuse of the auto-tune, like I just find it kind of annoying. Mm-hmm. But,
well, really quick, I'm going to give you a proper introduction, Amarnath. For everybody out there, hi, my name is Chris. This is Chitash, and today I'm joined by a guest, Dr. Amarnath Amarasingham from Queen's University, professor, researcher, author. If you'd like, please introduce yourself for the audience.
Sure, yeah. I'm Amarnath Amarasingham. I'm an associate professor in the School of Religion, cross-appointed to the Department of Political Studies at Queen's University. I study extremism of all stripes, from the far right to jihadist groups to conspiracy theories and online dynamics around extremism and social movements, and a whole host of other issues. So, yeah.
growing up, did you always know that you wanted to go down this path?
So it's an interesting story. I mean, I think 9/11 was my first day of undergrad, and so I don't know what I wanted to do in undergrad, but then just seeing 9/11 and then the consequences of 9/11, I kind of got obsessed with history, religious studies, political science, and kind of majored in history, minored in political science and religion, and kind of was studying that stuff pretty closely. I didn't really think about becoming a professor or anything like that, being a full-time researcher, but that eventually kind of seemed like the thing to do because I wasn't really good at anything else. And so it just kind of followed from undergrad to grad school and so on. So it was kind of the natural progression over time, I think.
This area of study regarding conspiracy theories, and I had never really known that this was a highly researched area until I had found out about Dr. Michael Barkin, and I had him on the podcast some time ago. What do you think makes today special for this area of study?
I think there were always conspiracy theories, for as far back as I think humans have existed. If you look at, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, kind of an anti-Semitic hoax document from the early 20th century, you had, the Posse Comitatus, and you had the John Birch Society following the Cold War, which basically said that the civil rights movement in the United States was a communist plot, and that, there's all this other stuff going on in the country. There were UFO conspiracy theories throughout the 90s. There were the moon landing, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's always been conspiracy theories. The difference now potentially is the mainstreaming of some of these bad ideas, and that, now you're hearing them from the loudest soapboxes, from mainstream television, your political leaders, from the president of the United States on down. These ideas used to be kind of fringe ideas that people held, and whatever research existed into them were kind of, these fun-loving topics that people did, right? So there was all these books that came out in the 90s and 2000s, like the 100 of the world's most, funniest conspiracy theories, kind of, those kinds of books. And so no one ever really looked at these ideas as a threat to public order, threat to public safety, threat to democracy, threat to our social fabric. And so now I think that's the major shift that's happened, is that people are seeing it as, it's influencing elections, it's influencing public health during the pandemic. It's having much more wider societal impact, and so there's a kind of urgency to understand it and study it a bit more, I think. Mm-hmm.
So something like maybe years ago, where somebody would read, just throwing somebody out there, like Zechariah Sitchin's, and there was that, but today you hear on there's a lot of podcasts, History Channel has Ancient Aliens. So it's just grown. It's way more mainstream, like you were saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also has kind of spilled over into violence as well. Right. So you had the QAnon movement, which has, I think, people have counted over 100 kind of criminal incidents associated with the QAnon movement, from kidnapping of children to storming of people's houses and things like that, including threats against Biden and political officials. So it's not just these kind of whimsical ideas that people held anymore. They're actually having broader societal impact. Stop the Steal movement is another, the societal problems that an idea like that creates, to say this election is not is being stolen from you, it goes to the heart of trust in institutions and trust in society that keeps everything moving forward. I think there's just a lot more. There's a lot more dangerous ones floating around these days than there used to be, I think.
And do you think that conspiracy theories have become religion for some people?
I mean, it depends how you define religion, I guess. But I mean, in the sense of this kind of all-encompassing worldview, that's definitely the case. The kind of deeper you go down for some of these conspiracy theories. I mean, I've interviewed a few QAnon adherents who'd left the movement, and they describe it as that, right? This kind of, they woke up in the morning and they were thinking about QAnon ideas. They were online 6 to 7 to 8 hours a day on these platforms and going down different rabbit holes. They really thought that the world was going to change imminently and that they were one of the vanguards who was going to come along and kind of save society, that society depended on them to kind of, you know, free all these young children who were being held captive and by Hollywood elites or Democratic elites. And so it does become this kind of all-encompassing worldview. I mean, some conspiracy theories do have that quality. I haven't met anyone who believes in the moon landing was faked or that or the Earth is flat who kind of is also, has this kind of all-encompassing worldview about it. But things like QAnon, things like Stop the Steal, things like, I don't know, society kind of being overrun, the Great Replacement Theory is another one. It does kind of become all-encompassing for some people because of that kind of urgency, I think, right? There's some of these ideas have a level of moral urgency to them that there's an imminent destruction coming, imminent change coming, and you personally need to do something about it. And so they have this kind of quality of getting people, out of their chairs and really riled up about becoming part of this revolution that's supposed to be around the corner.
And has there been research done into why people gravitate towards conspiracy theories? Like, what are the main reasons?
I think there's some people talk about kind of three different kinds of motivations. One of them is usually what's known as epistemic motives, and so this kind of need for explanation. They also call it kind of proportionality bias, and so this idea that the larger an event, the greater the cause of that event must be. And so the JFK assassination is a good example of this, where the idea that the president of the United States was killed by this one guy in a book depository just doesn't kind of feel comfortable for people, right? It's not psychologically satisfying that something so momentous was done by just one person. And so they tend to look for equally momentous explanations for why something like that happened. COVID is another example. Like, a virus that brought the entire planet to a screeching halt could not possibly have been an accident that kind of leaked out into a lab or something like that. There must be something else going on, right? And so people look for these explanations that are kind of psychologically satisfying for them. Another explanation is existential motives. And so this idea that we're living in a world that is more chaotic. You have less control over what happens around you. COVID is another example. Another good example of this is that you were just going about your day, taking your kids to work and going to work and living your life. And all of a sudden, everything is uprooted and everything is turned upside down. And so you lose control over your life and your surroundings and your loved ones. And so there is a need to kind of gain that control back or get that control back in some way. And conspiracy theories are excellent at doing that. They come along and say, here's who you blame and here's who caused it. And here's how, here's the people that are to blame behind this. And so they have a ability to kind of give you a cause and effect that's quite satisfying. And more and more, I guess the third explanation is these societal motives. And that's happening more and more in the online space where the online community, the friends in your community, conspiracy community online, become very important to you, right? And so the relationships that people have formed in the online space keep people continuously in these movements. And this is where there's some good examples with the Stop the Steal movement or even the QAnon movement where they thought, they would set a date where something is supposed to happen, that date would come and go. And the online community was pivotal for kind of making that failure of prophecy palatable, right? And how do you get beyond the failure prophecy? Well, here's, you know, we were all mistaken, or we were, you know, actually a new date is more accurate, etc. And so the online community is, I think, quite important for keeping these people firmly entrenched in some of these conspiracy communities. So I would kind of point to those three things.
And I wanted to ask you specifically about QAnon, and forgive me if you just mentioned this just earlier, but comparing something like QAnon to something else that doesn't really have violence associated with it that I know of, you know, you could maybe say flat earth or stuff with UFOs and UAPs, although I know I've heard of cults surrounded around the belief in UFOs and such, but believing, or people who believe in these things, we don't see the same violence that I'm aware of. And with QAnon, we have seen violence stem from that. And what would you say is the...
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team, or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Biggest reason for that dichotomy there between something like QAnon and something else like flat earth UFO.
Yeah. I mean, my personal kind of view on this is that QAnon was able to tap into a level of moral urgency in its adherence that it made it kind of impossible to do nothing, right? So if I truly believe that Hollywood elites and Democratic government elites are trafficking in children, and that's something that's not something I'm just saying out loud, but something that I actually believe. It doesn't really make sense to dedicate your life to anything else except to help these children, right? And so that has kind of tapped into a, I don't know if revolutionary spirit is the right word, but this kind of moral crusade to kind of save these children, do something about it, which the flat earth, moon landing, you know, Elvis Presley is still alive, and Loch Ness monster, all these things don't really tap into, right? And so I think that for me is what's unique about QAnon in particular, is that it was, and you're dealing with kind of the purity of children and helping children and saving children. And so it was able to tap into a kind of moral core where if you come to truly believe that this is happening, it's very difficult to just kind of know that that's happening and move on with your day. And so you have a lot more people kind of agitated because of it, right? And so I think that's the kind of unique aspect of QAnon.
And diving deeper into QAnon, this was something I didn't realize, and I had listened to an interview, or actually it was a presentation that you gave about how there were other people or other users that were posting in a similar style or similar content related to QAnon, but it seems like they didn't really take off like QAnon did. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain that, like why didn't they take off, and why did QAnon end up, you know, overcoming all these other previous users?
So I mean, I think this was part of the kind of the 4chan culture, right? There was FBI Anons, there were CIA Anons, there were all these other posts or individuals posting, claiming to be embedded in these government organizations, releasing secrets slowly to the public. And so it was part of that kind of chan culture in some ways that this would happen. I think what's different is the way in which a similar idea popping up on 4chan was then taken by some very particular individuals and put onto a kind of larger platform, namely their YouTube live streams, right? And so once you had that happen, people like Pamphlet Anon and Baruch the Scribe, you know, took it out of the kind of sewers of the internet that is 4chan, and gave it to kind of minor YouTube celebrities, and from there it got picked up by other news outlets and other influencers, and then it ended up on Alex Jones' TV or his show. And from the Alex Jones show, it kind of exploded, and then it got picked up by the Trump team. And Trump himself retweeted and reposted a whole host of QAnon ideas leading into the election. And so it kind of went from, you know, very fringe corners of the internet on 4chan and slowly made its way through YouTube influencers through to Alex Jones, through to the Trump team. And so it's not necessarily anything about the QAnon idea itself that made it more popular than the other Anons, but it was more so who was listening and who was willing to amplify it. And that's kind of how it got out of control, I think.
And do we know if there was like a certain event or trigger to that very first QAnon post? And I guess as a second question, when exactly did the posts of QAnon start?
So the very first post was in October 2017, October 28th, 2017, where an anonymous user posted that Hillary Clinton was about to be arrested and a whole host of things were about to change. And so that was kind of the first Q post. And then from there, there were dozens and dozens of others kind of posting similar messages from the point of view of, you know, I am part of the kind of pro-Trump resistance inside the government, and there is a deep state of kind of pedophile elites who are trying to, you know, destroy Trump and make sure evil triumphs in the world, etc. And so I think it started in 2017. The last Q post, I'm trying to remember now when it was, but it was sometime in December 2021, I think, or 2020 maybe. And so basically we have, you know, a couple thousand Q posts from that period that were part of the original QAnon movement. The movement itself has now evolved and branched out into different issues and different iterations. But that's kind of the you know, early core of it.
And just speaking of that, do we know any reason on why QAnon stopped posting?
I don't know why they stopped posting. I think there was a lot of attention. I mean, most researchers that I know think that, you know, Jim and Ron Watkins were behind some of these QAnon posts. And there was a lot of documentaries that came out at the time. There were there's a lot of media attention on them. There was also, I think, Ron Watkins ran for Congress or something like that around that time. And so I think it made maybe strategic sense for him to distance himself from any posts online that might be traceable or that might receive attention. There hasn't necessarily been a rebirth of any of these posts, but that's kind of when they kind of came to an end.
And this was something else that I never knew, because I always just considered QAnon was the message was consistent. And I know you had mentioned just the contents of that first post of QAnon, but the message or the theme was not always the same. And eventually later on, this child element entered into the picture. And I was wondering if you can kind of explain that, like how, if that was accurate, and kind of the evolution of the theme of their posts.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, part of that influence came from a similar movement. I guess it's a movement or similar conspiracy theory that was happening in the online space known as the Pizzagate conspiracy. Pizzagate is a bit older than QAnon, and it kind of traces back to March 2016 when Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta, had his emails hacked. They were posted online by WikiLeaks in November 2016. People on the internet started to go through his emails and do a kind of, I don't know, a rewrite of it in some ways, and find references to child pornography and children and boys and things like that. So they would say any mention of pillows in his emails actually meant drugs. Any mention of cheese pizza was actually a reference to child pornography. Any mention of pasta was actually a mention of boys. Any mention of chicken was a mention of young boys, etc. And so they kind of rewrote these emails with reference to, sex trafficking and child pornography. And so the Pizzagate movement was progressing on 4chan. The QAnon movement started popping up on 4chan. And initially, the Q posts were largely just about Hillary Clinton and the arrest of Hillary Clinton and the cabal. And it's over time that these kind of two movements came together, right? And so it's the Pizzagate conspiracy's influence on QAnon that inserted, in many ways, the child sex trafficking component. And they just kind of fused together and became a similar movement at the time. But each of those ideas have a kind of their own separate origins.
Now, I had seen that there was some work done in the UK regarding surveys of the population and trying to see if there was a correlation between, belief in QAnon and violence. And I forget if you were involved in this study. I was wondering if you can kind of explain a little bit about that research and what was found from that.
I'm trying to remember that is a study by Bettina Rottweiler and Paul Gill. I was involved with some of that work, but not all of that work. And so what they found was that the more people believed in QAnon conspiracy theories, and the more they self-identified as right wing politically, the higher they scored on violent extremist intentions. And so it was an interesting kind of overlay of different things to say that the more, if you believe in QAnon conspiracy beliefs, but you identify as left wing on the spectrum, you are less likely to answer yes or no, answer in supportive of any violent extremist intentions or anti-government violence, that sort of thing. But if you sprinkle kind of right-wing political ideology on top of that, or you self-identify as right-wing, then your commitment to violent extremism and anti-government violence goes through the roof, right? And so it kind of showed that it's not necessarily just enough to hold bad ideas, but it's how these bad ideas intersect with your political leanings, and then how all of that kind of influences how you relate to violence, whether you see violence as justified, obligatory, and so on. So it kind of means that, it's not necessarily that you just have bad ideas, but it's a whole host of the cocktail of bad ideas plus your political leanings plus some certain psychological traits that they were also able to find all have a impact on whether you see violence as necessary.
In that study, do you know, are any of the results broken down by like race or gender as well? And are there any studies out there that also break it down further into those categories?
Not that I know of off the top. I know they probably didn't look at that or haven't looked at that in depth, but that would be an interesting way to go, because I do think the intersection of gender and masculine identity as kind of protectors is important. But at the same time, Marc-Andre Argentino, looking at, I think, the numbers of QAnon cases that he is able to tabulate, over 100 or over 200 now, petty crime plus major crimes, does see a pretty large presence of women who are involved in these cases. And so, and some of the more high profile ones like Jessica Prim and so on are women. And so it would be interesting kind of to dig into that more for sure.
And do you know, are there any plans to do a study of this magnitude in the U.S. as well?
I know that Paul Gill and Bettina Rottweiler are doing a similar survey that they did in Germany and the U.K. in the U.S., but I don't think any of the results are in yet.
Okay.
But they're looking at the intersection between conspiracy theories, public health conspiracies, violent and violent extremism.
And I know the study that we were just mentioning that was done in the UK, it always kind of felt that, and maybe it's just because I live here in the US, that conspiracy theories and beliefs are the most prominent here in the US. And I don't know if what you thought, if in other countries, is it as prevalent as it is in the US?
I'm not sure there's kind of comparative numbers that could say definitively, but there's definitely conspiracy theories everywhere on the planet. I mean, I think the UK numbers were pretty scary when they asked about, Bettina and Paul asked about anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, QAnon and so on. The numbers were, 8-9% of the population. For a country of 70 million people in the UK, that's a pretty large number of people who, hold great replacement theory ideas and anti-Semitic ideas, and just walk around with the rest of us. That there's that. There's also, I think, if you look at India or Myanmar or Sri Lanka, there's these kind of state-adjacent or state-orchestrated conspiracy theories as well, where they think, Muslims are having too many kids and are slowly going to take over the population things like that. That Muslims are secretly sterilizing the women of the majority population, and all these other conspiracy theories also are existent in some of these countries. Some of them are, from the majority, from the majoritarian ethnic community or religious community, less kind of lone actor violence, and so those dynamics are interesting as well in terms of how they play out in some of these South Asian countries.
Are there any sort of particular things about a person themselves, like let's say personality-wise, that would lend them to more likely believe in a conspiracy theory?
I don't think there's any evidence that there's a kind of personality trait that would draw you to conspiracy theories. It's more so, again, kind of the kind of cocktail of beliefs, world events, lifestyle circumstances, and I guess in the social media world, what kind of the algorithmic consequences of your scrolling and your searches that kind of take you into different rabbit holes and different kind of ecosystems of belief that basically can happen to any of us, right? And so, I think a lot of the biases that we talk about, confirmation bias, et cetera, exist in all of us, and we're all capable of falling down different rabbit holes and different belief systems. It's just a question of how dangerous some of these ideas can become. There's also a broader problem these days of collapse in trust of institutions and kind of traditional mechanisms of information, right? So science, medicine, journalism, academia, mainstream media, et cetera, the kind of trust that people have, trust that some people have in these institutions, which would help you navigate accurate information versus false information, et cetera. There's a lot less trust in these institutions. And people live in entirely alternate information silos, whether it's on platforms like Telegram or what have you. So that also contributes to kind of the longevity of some of these ideas. The other, I guess, addition to that is once you believe, one thing is clear in all the evidence on conspiracy theories is that once you believe in one conspiracy theory, you're much more likely to believe in a bunch of others. And part of the reason for that is not necessarily the idea itself, but if you start to believe that the world around you is lying to you, that what you see is not real and there are sinister actors at play and everything you see is manipulated and everything you see is manipulated to kind of keep you subdued, it's hard to just believe in the moon landing was faked, but I believe what the mainstream media is telling me about everything else, right? Or vaccines cause autism, but I believe what medical professionals have to tell me about everything else. It's kind of hard to do that. And so once you believe in one conspiracy, you're more likely to distrust the entire institution that's feeding you these kinds of more reputable pieces of information. And so people start to go down multiple rabbit holes of belief, and it really starts to change your entire worldview in many ways.
Now, have you had any conversations with any big tech executives about their platforms and the dissemination of conspiracy theories on their platforms, or do you think are these large tech companies at least aware of these ideas?
They're very much aware. I've had on and off conversations with almost every social media platform and their trust and safety branches within these platforms. It's not so much that they don't know it's there or they know how to take it down, because they did take down all of QAnon, for example, after the January 6th insurrection. But again, that was in hindsight, right? And so this is an ongoing challenge that they struggle with, is when is a bad idea? Because they're not going to take down all dumb ideas on the internet, right? and so when is a dumb idea a dangerous idea? And how do we know that this isn't just bad information online as opposed to something that's going to cause consequences? And so they left QAnon standing for a long, long time until January 6th, until there was actual incidents of violence, and then they decided to take it all down. It's not an enviable position where they find in which they find themselves, because they also don't want to be the arbiters of truth and draw lines around free speech and things like that. And so it's a constant push and pull, I think, about what information is just bad information, wrong information that we can correct in other ways, or should just be disinfected by sunlight of these kind of platforms, and what should be taken down, right? And so when ISIS was, for example, when ISIS was roaming around Twitter and some of these mainstream platforms, those decisions were quite easy because, nobody wants a beheading video as soon as they log on to Twitter. That debate is much harder when you're talking about stop the steal or build a wall or, Muslim ban, et cetera, right? So some of these topics become a lot more blurry in terms of where they fall on the free speech line, and they become even more blurry when they come from the top, right? And so platforms have always had a hard time suspending, blocking, removing content from the president of the United States or the prime minister of whatever country, because for them they see it they see these accounts as kind of important to leave up, that's the kind of ongoing challenge they're dealing with, is where to kind of make these decisions. It's not that they don't know about it or they don't know how to take it down, but should they take it down, and so on. Of course, with Elon Musk coming in, a lot of these guardrails have been removed. And so he got rid of the trust and safety team entirely. He got rid of the human rights team for the most part. And so a lot of the policies they had built up over the last 10 years have now been shelved for the most part. And so that's why you saw Alex Jones come screaming back onto Twitter. And a lot of these other open neo-Nazis come screaming back onto Twitter. And so now we're kind of back to square one in many ways on Twitter in particular. So,
do you think, because this is something that I hear a lot of, that you fight, I forget the exact quote. It's like, if you fight bad speech with good speech or something like that. And, I guess the best example I can maybe think of this is on YouTube. If you are watching, let's say, a flat earth video, there will most of the times be a banner at the bottom of the video, and it'll have like a Wikipedia link, and it'll link you to flat earth, and it'll kind of explain from there, hey, flat earth is a debunked theory that the earth is flat, it's not round or oval shaped, etc. Do you think that things like that can be an effective solution to fighting against conspiracy theories?
I think so. I think that's largely what Elon Musk's new approach is with Twitter community notes and things like that, is that it's now up to us to, up to the users of these platforms to kind of fact check each other and so on. Of course, that can be weaponized, and it's not necessarily ideal. The other problem, of course, is how susceptible people are to being fact checked at all, right? So once you lose that trust in institutions and mainstream sources of information, you see all of that as part of the plot, and all of that as suspect. And so when someone posts a PolitiFact link or a Snopes link, they don't trust these sources of information, so it doesn't make any real dent, right? And so that, I think, is the larger challenge, is not so much the lack of information, because I mean, we all have the entirety of human knowledge in our pockets now with our phones, and so it's not so much that there's a lack of information or a lack of access to information. It's that we don't trust the sources of information. And that is a much larger problem, because that basically is the slow erosion of democratic discourse, right? Is that we can no longer talk to each other because we live in different planets. I think it's raining outside and you think it's sunny outside, because the website you read and the website I read told us two different things. So that's the problem, is that and we saw this during COVID a lot on some of these Telegram channels, where they would say, I'm not taking the vaccine because I don't know what's in it, and I don't know whether it's been tested properly and so on. But then they would the entire Telegram group would be talking about ivermectin and ivermectin, and I forget the other one, hydrochloroquine and all these things, right? So clearly they're willing to put stuff in their bodies, right? And it's just a question of who do I trust to tell me the correct information about the thing that I'm going to put in my body. I don't trust Fauci anymore. I don't trust CNN. I don't trust the NIH, but I trust this small group of people that I've gotten to know in this Telegram group, right? When you find yourself there as a society, then it's not so much about, let's just tell them the facts, because, well, they don't care about the facts, and they don't trust you as the one that's telling them the facts. And that's kind of the larger challenge. And I don't know how you get beyond that, because I just see that polarization increasing as time goes on, not necessarily, you know, reversing. So we're going to end up in a situation where, yeah, we just live in very different worlds.
And is it challenging, or is it hard covering or researching these topics, and that if there's like a fine line between glorifying something and by giving it coverage, but by also giving it coverage you're criticizing it, but maybe some people might misconstrue it as glorifying? And an example I can think of is the movie, there was an HBO documentary, Q Into the Storm, which I thought it was very good, but I guess I didn't realize that there were critics of it that said that it didn't, maybe it didn't do enough in showing the really dangerous sides of QAnon. And I was wondering what you thought about that, if you've had those challenges in your work and research.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing debate, I think, amongst extremism scholars, is how much do we tell the public about the stuff that we see online, and how much if it is actual fringe. It was an easier debate to have when extremism was on the fringe, and when people, you know, not every person on the street was on Telegram and was looking at kind of the darkest corners of the internet. But now I think that debate's changed a bit in the field, where because it's so mainstream, because it's so out there, there is a necessity to kind of talk about it and put context to it a little bit more. So because the argument before was we're exposing people who haven't heard of these ideas before to these ideas. But now that argument's shifted entirely, which is everyone's heard these ideas. They're being spoken from the, top highest levels of government and highest levels of media or podcasts and so on. And so now the equation has changed a bit to kind of, we need to talk about it, and we need to provide, bring our expertise to kind of explain and denounce it in some way. It's definitely an ongoing conversation in the field, and I've been accused of it myself when I used to interview ISIS fighters and interview neo-Nazis and tweet about it and put that stuff online, where people just said, why are you giving these guys a platform? But I've always said, people need to understand, parents need to understand the kinds of information that their kids are being exposed to, the kind of platforms their children are on, the information their children are getting. It doesn't make any sense for people like us to kind of just know this stuff and keep it in our pockets. I've kind of waffled on it over time, I think, but, I'm now on the, get all the accurate information out there. and I think that's probably more helpful.
Now, for the future, where does the future lie for you and your research? And is there anything that you're currently working on?
So we're finishing, me and Marc Andre are finishing a book on called Dangerous Conspiracies, where we kind of look at the same things we've been talking about today, is why or how are some conspiracy theories producing violence and others are less dangerous. So that book will be out next year at some point. Ongoing, I think I'm keeping a close eye on the election results and the consequences that might happen in January, either from the right or the left. And then I think the question for me is much, much broader, in the sense of what does another 4 years of Trump and the people that he seems to be wanting to appoint do to the institutions of the American society, right? What does the FBI look like after 4 years? What does the education department look like after 4 years? What does the Pentagon look like after 4 years? And are we going to, what does NATO look like after 4 years? And what does the Middle East look like after 4 years, right? And I think there are consequences there that we haven't really thought about, and so that's going to be what I'm worried about going forward.
Well, Amarnath, thank you very much for sitting down with me and having this conversation. Really, really appreciate it. And one final question for you is, for people who want to connect with you, how can they do that? I know you have a Twitter, am I right?
Yeah, I'm still on Twitter. Just so my full name, if you type in my full name on Twitter or Blue Sky, you can find me pretty easily. I'm on Google Scholar and academia.edu if you want to see actual publications or read any of the actual publications. My email is pretty easily available online, so if people have follow-up questions or stuff they want to talk about, feel free to email me as well.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'll include links to those in the description of the episode. And thank you. No, once again, this was a very great conversation. Really fascinated by this topic, and just, yeah, thank you for taking the time and coming on the podcast.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
And for everybody else out there, thank you very much for listening. My name is Chris. This has been Chitash. Take care, everybody.